Memphis, Representative Boyer. The committee shall disregard the proposed CS that's in your packet. It was my intention to, it was my intention on House Bill 284 to bring before you the proposed amendments in drafting form, each individual amendment, and then let you take a look at them. And then based on, you know, take a look at them today, and then my intention is to move this bill out of this committee on a week from today. And I could possibly do it on Tuesday, but my real intention is to get it out on Thursday. My deadline is, it'll be out of here, whether it's in the current form, amended form, some form, a week from today. But the amendments that were incorporated into the CS by error are enclosed in conceptual form in the March 15th, 1990 prompt pay public construction contracts memorandum from the last municipal league. So what I'd like to do is bring municipal, who would be the best person? Crystal? Bring Crystal Smith up. And maybe at the same time, with you, the sponsor, or anybody else you'd like to have join us, walk through these amendments and get at least a conceptual understanding and a sensing from the committee as to which amendments you would at least, maybe we don't even need to go through the exercise of wanting to take up or not. You all have that memo, this one here, it's got the proposed amendments in it. The on 284, amendment number one that was proposed that the bill apply only in situations where municipalities actually sign a contract with state funds, i.e. not applicable to non or no state capital funds were used. I was wondering whether or not, first of all, I get the municipal league's position on it, then the sponsor's position, and anybody else would like to respond on that particular proposed amendment. Crystal Smith, for the record.
My name is Crystal Smith. I'm with the Alaska Municipal League, Senator Zemanski and members of the committee. Our position on this first item is that if a municipality is using its own funds for a construction project, that we do not feel it's the state should be in the position of telling the municipalities what to do with those funds. And if the state, if state funds are involved, and that would be a part of the contract of signing the state funds for grants for a construction project.
Representative Boyer.
Just a question. We have in statute a definition of state money, and yet it continues to be confused at almost every juncture. What does the Municipal League consider to be state money? Would that include debt repayment for a project, or I'd like to have some sense for the record what it is that you think you mean when you say state money.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Boyer. As I understand it from through the municipalities and the definition that they were and our legislative committee were comfortable with would be something where there was a particular grant or a particular project for which they had to sign a contract with you and those and with the state, and that would be they would be comfortable with that.
What about a loan, Mr. Chairman?
I would think I would have to defer to some of the members of the municipalities who are online. I understand with the teleconference, and because they are the ones who came up with this issue.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of like the last possible compromise that I'm willing to take is this particular language. We've compromised. I think we compromised on the House side, and this is one that I think, if it doesn't hit at the heart of the last of the real concerns of municipal governments, I don't know what does. But I want to be absolutely sure before I agree to anything that we all understand that state money is state money in all of its varied manifestations, which includes loans or grants or repayments. I mean, we have a fairly broad definition, but it doesn't ever seem to be all-inclusive. And if generating your own dollars means, and using your own dollars means tax-supported, locally generated money, or if you go to the bond market and secure financing for a project where there's no state reimbursement, there's no state loan as a match or otherwise being a part of that, if that's what you mean, then I think that we probably have an understanding and probably have some room for a final compromise, but if you need something else.
If I understand the sponsor's suggestion, that we narrowly or broadly define state monies, your intention to make it grant monies, and we would not include loan monies, and I guess I'd get a sense from the committee on that. You would say that if state monies would be direct or indirect?
If there's a buck involved, and it looks and smells and tastes like a state buck in any of its manifestations, if there's any assistance that isn't locally generated or locally derived or locally retired, then it's state money.
Senator Pichot.
One of the most obvious questions on that would be how do you treat municipal assistance and revenue sharing?
State money. It's a grant.
I think from our position that would not be considered state money. That's money that is given to the municipality for operations of municipal government, and wherever the municipal government opts to put it into a construction project, or opts to put it into roads, or opts to put it into whatever, it's local option and what that money is used for. And I think that would be my position. At the time you've given it to the municipality, then it's theirs to use to at their best priority.
The other question that I have associated with that is, what happens when you have commingled money? It's 90% local government contribution and 10% state. Do you claim the immunity?
Now, Senator Zemanski, there again, I would want to defer to you. I believe we have a legislative committee member on the line. As I recall in our discussion of this at the legislative committee meeting and our discussions of how what compromises we could live with and how we could accept the bill, that discussion came up, and I believe
who's online?
I believe that Judy Slager's online from Fairbanks. She had indicated to me that she would be. Can somebody tell me that?
Judy, are you online?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, for the record.
Judy Slager, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. With regard to commingled money, that certainly would be an issue. As those funds that are not direct grants, where we do not sign a contract for a specific project, those monies might be municipal assistance, state revenue sharing, school debt reimbursement, business fisheries tax sharing, and then the laundry list goes on and on and on.
Okay.
Dollars go into the general fund of a local government, as do their tax revenues and everything else. And so once they are budgeted, some portion of those might be budgeted for a new ceiling at the Westcott Pool, for instance. Our position is, from the local government's position when we review this legislation, is that we really have no problem with the applicability to those dollars that are earmarked for capital projects that are coming from the legislature, i.e. a grant. Those projects, we do sign a grant agreement with the state of Alaska, and the conditions for the use of that money is set out in the grant agreement.
So you would or would not have a problem imposing the statute or prompt payment on anything that has $1 or more state money?
When there's a direct appropriation for a capital project using state funds, we do not have a problem with that. When the borough would sign a contract with the state of Alaska for the use of those funds.
Representative Boyd.
A few more years.
You're looking across at Frank when you're saying
that. Not directly, no.
I think he's thinking about it. He's looking your way.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's, we've defined state money in a number of areas, and that the definition of state money is much broader than the definition that Ms.
What would
Slager,
you like to see? Since you're making a concession.
I absolutely make a concession. I would like to see state money defined in all of its broadest manifestations. As I've said before, I think that there is it becomes a little bit of an accounting problem, but if someone is using municipal assistance, that is state money. If someone's using revenue sharing, that is state money. If they're getting 80% reimbursement for a project or getting a 95% guaranteed loan from some program or 100, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of things that we may do in the future that are in fact state money. They've got, they ought to be included. If you're building or acquiring something with state dollars, it ought to apply here.
Senator Pichot.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we got to look at this practically. In my community, we probably had last year $20 or $25 million in direct state grants that would perhaps qualify under a narrow version. But in addition, we had about $40 million of revenue sharing, municipal assistance, shared taxes, for $65 million out of a $175 million budget. Now, and I don't know how much of the 175 goes in direct payroll versus purchasing, but if you're only a fraction of the rest of the so-called pure property tax municipal monies that is buying pencils and papers and anything else, construction contracts, it's possible to have a 50-50 system or a 40-60 system involving state and city. If you're a contracting officer or a payment person, you're not going to have two parallel systems. So I think that if you get into a general definition of state funds and you include revenue sharing municipal assistance, then you might as well just make it whole hog. That it doesn't seem to, it seems pointless to try to allow cities or to permit cities or force them into a two-system accounting system, one that has triggers for 30 days and one that doesn't. And I mean, I think that if it's a substantial portion of a city's purchasing or their construction contracts, then you might as well have one system.
This is all.
And it's just
all money just, that the local government spends. Right where to get it.
That seems to be more practical than trying to separate out fairly large chunks of money.
Senator Frank, you have a comment?
I think, frankly, I haven't heard and have yet to be all that convinced that the bill is a problem for municipalities. I would be, you know, certainly willing to listen to those general concerns. But I would also agree with Senator Pichot that it doesn't make sense to have two systems, and if we are going to require it for a grant and or including municipal assistance and revenue sharing, there isn't any practical way of separating them out. If they can do it for grants, it seems like they should be able to do it for their general government. If they can't do it for grants, then we better understand that and you know, and make sure that we understand their problems and you know, and deal with it probably in a consistent manner. Either, you know, decide, you know, what they can do, and because I think as a practical matter, what they can do for a grant, they can also do for the other.
Is there anybody else, either on the teleconference or present today, that would like to talk about amendment number one, proposed amendment number one? And if not, I'd like to move ahead to discuss the second one that has been advanced by the Municipal League.
We have someone in Anchorage.
Okay, speak up.
Hello, this is Roxanne Herschel, and I did have just one more comment on the number one point. We're at a loss here, so we do appreciate you going through each of the points. We do not have a copy of the amendments here in Anchorage. I don't know if they do anyplace else. But possibly someone could slip out of the committee real quick and fax it to us so that we have that as a working copy.
I'll tell you what we'll do as we're doing that. We'll fax you a copy of what we're working off of Scott Burgess's letter to us from Municipal League, which were incorporated as amendments into a CS, which I've set aside and not wanted to bring before the committee. What I'm trying to do is draw a sense as to whether or not we should even advance to the committee an amendment on each of the points that have been advanced by the Municipal League to us. As I announced earlier, I intend to move the bill along in some form a week from today. My feeling is that the amendment is still open for some discussion, which can occur between now and Thursday or sometime before then. Actually, it'll be, have to be on Wednesday. There'll have to be a member of CS, the committee. But the amendment to the bill would simply exclude any funds on projects that were non-state. In other words, if you spent any money on a, if you did a project that was not state funded in any way, shape, or form, then you wouldn't, it wouldn't come underneath the act. And the discussion to date appears that there's some room in there, but it doesn't seem like a whole lot. So do you have a comment on that particular amendment?
Yes, I'd be happy to comment on it. First of all, I'd like to point out to everyone that we're talking only on paying interest if, in fact, payments are late. And there seems to be a big problem in motions with all of the municipalities here recently, maybe a fiscal note or the problems that they're going to have to pay their bill promptly. I, for one, have a real problem with anyone that cannot seem to manage us in business-like manner and pay their bills promptly. We're talking within 30 days. That is standard within our industry. And the private sector, we're all paying our bills within 30 days. And I think everyone, I'm speaking for all of the subcontractors and general contractors, that we do have a problem when these public officials are standing up in front of us taxpayers and saying, I'm sorry, we cannot pay you small businesses on time, and we just can't afford the interest.
Okay.
We have put in the bill here a section where they can pay that interest out of the state grants, and I think that it should all be included. Everyone should pay their bills promptly, on time, within 30 days.
Okay, I appreciate it. What I'd hope to do, and let me kind of give you a general instruction to anybody out there that's listening. The way I'd like to conduct the business today is to zero in on a specific amendment. I don't want to debate the merits of the issue as a general issue. We did that in a previous hearing. We've heard testimony on the merits of it. There's obviously points and counterpoints. My concern before this committee is that we generally have to have a compelling reason to impose or take away the powers of local government, and that's what we're doing in this bill. We are telling local governments how to do business in a blanket statewide basis. This bill could be before the Anchorage Assembly as a resolution, and the local government could enact it itself if they wanted. So there's nothing that says they couldn't do it in any other local government, but I doubt that they there'd be much hope at the local level in doing it. So I just want to caution people that what appears to be sometimes questioning or scrutiny about this is the fact that we are using the strength of the state constitution to impose this condition on local governments, which we traditionally do very cautiously. So with that, the only thing that the local governments the Municipal League local governments have offered up to us is considering only because they want us to say, okay, if you're going to impose it on us, should we tag it on to only state funds? We're going to leave that open for discussion. Does anybody else want to talk about that amendment?
Dave Palmer, Peterson.
Go ahead. And restate your name, please.
And, my name is Dave Palmer. I'm city manager in Petersburg. Just follow up on what you mentioned without going through the merits of this thing, because I think I can agree that we should all pay our bills on time. I don't know why the bills just apply to the cities. Maybe it should apply to all businesses. But with regard to amendment number one, I sat in on the AML legislative committee discussions on this, and my impression was that the feeling of that group was that there may be a compelling reason for the legislature to get involved in the way local governments do business if that business relates directly to grant funds that come from the state. If the state legislature is concerned that the municipalities aren't being responsible with the legislative money that comes as a result of a direct contract for legislative grants, then maybe this bill is appropriate. But for the same reason, I think the committee felt that other city councils should be left on their own if they want to do business or not do business in a proper manner, and let them suffer the consequences that are already went out under the law for paying or not paying their bills on time, and that really isn't a legitimate function of the legislature to get down to the government business at that level. So my feeling was that the committee wanted a fairly strict reading
Thank you. Does anybody else like to comment? Hearing none. The next amendment proposed, and I will read it for those who are on the teleconference in conceptual form, is amend the bill so that the deadlines and interest would not apply during the warranty period, in addition to the interest on retainage provisions in the contract. The reasoning given by Mr. Belig is that most contracts have a warranty period during which the contractor guarantees the project, and during which the municipality may retain a portion of the contract fee due to ensure compliance and satisfactory performance. The 30 to 21 payment deadline interest provision should not apply during this period. Municipalities are required to pay interest on retaining gender current law. The bill would not require municipality to pay the interest twice. Comments by Ms. Belief.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this is fairly self-explanatory in the discussion here. As we said, during almost every contract has a warranty period, and construction will have a warranty period, and there is a requirement for payment of interest on the retainage during that period, and we don't feel that the municipality should have to pay that interest twice, once if they haven't, because for some reason the bill hasn't gotten cleared up during that time, because the engineers haven't finished the clearance on it, the punch list hasn't been taken care of in terms of the requirements of the audit of the project, whatever needs to be finished up, which on construction projects very often takes 30 to 60 days, and that those things that are, the partial payment might have been made and the other money was being carried over to ensure that the work was completed properly. The league's position, the municipality's position, is they shouldn't be required to be paying interest on that because they are holding the retainage, which would have been mm-hmm. established in the contract period, and because their payment was, quote, late, even though the project was still under consideration.
Representative Boyer, my reading, and I guess it's more of my understanding of the current practice, is that your bill wouldn't have necessarily required the payment or damages on retainages in the first place, or would it?
It does require payment of interest on retainage, of course.
On the current, they have the ability to do it on retainage, but would your bill come into, would the prompt payment bill be affected where retainage is being maintained for warranty purposes?
I'm not sure on that. I don't know how to answer that. My only concern about this whole issue is that we make sure that we don't use a warranty period as just a way to hold additional money and not have to pay interest on that holding. So I haven't seen the language of the amendment, so don't know how tight that is, but I'm certainly flexible to work with that one between now and next Wednesday.
Do you have any questions about what they mean in regard to warranty period? Maybe I should get Senator Frank. He's
a contractor. I'm not a contractor. But I'd like to understand just how that warranty system works. I guess when I think of the word warranty, I think of a 5-year warranty or a 1-year warranty or something like that. But I'd like to, maybe you could take us through, how the retainage feature does work. You use the word punch list, which I understand. And I suspect that, getting those last few things cleared up is, it is problematic sometimes. And, the person retains the retainage, or the owner retains the retainage so that the contractor will finish the job, and that's very legitimate. I'm unsure in my own mind at this point how that all should work, and so I need to understand it better.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, I'm not a contractor either, and it's not. I'm also not a municipal manager or a finance officer. I think that we do have people who could deal with that. I think Mr. Palmer could probably explain that to you better than I could.
Okay,
I'd rather have somebody do that.
Is there anybody on teleconference that'd like to respond to Senator Frank's question?
Dave Palmer, Mr.
Okay, go ahead.
All I can say, I guess, is it depends. In a lot of the contracts we have, there might be a 1-year warranty period when we withhold a certain small percentage, 5%, usually 5 or 10%. For the warranty period, we pay interest on that. We just want to make sure we're paying interest on that, plus a penalty for late payment on top of it.
Well, let me ask you this. I guess I am a little concerned. I mean, there's a difference between, I didn't realize, to be candid with you, that anybody retained retainage on a warranty. A warranty in itself denotes that you're giving them a guarantee that if anything fails, you're going to come back and repair it. That's usually a contract stipulation, and it usually comes with the product that you produce. I'm a little confused between retainage that would be held for warranties and what normal retainages are held for incompleted work. Can you help me?
I don't know. I remember one provision in this bill that said that something to the effect that it applied notwithstanding a provision in a contract, and maybe we don't really have a problem if that's the case. It seems to me if the city and the contractor have a contract that provides for retainage or provides for a warranty period, and the city and the contractor each comply with that contract, we shouldn't be subject to an additional penalty. We are required, and we do pay interest on retainage for uncompleted work, and on the warranty, I'm not sure. We hold some money back, and I can't tell you off the top of my head whether we pay interest on that or not. I believe it's usually covered by the contract. Would the situation be corrected if we had a provision, it may be in there, that says that if we're complying with the provision of the contract, we don't get stuck with a penalty for late payment?
You got me on that one. Are we for either the person, the sponsor?
I think we're covered. I don't think that this is an issue because the bill compels you to enter into contracts, and yes, you can stipulate conditions in the contract, and I think we're covered, but I'll take another look at it as well.
Okay, anybody else want to comment on that proposal? Hearing none, we'll move to item 3.
Can you hear us?
Okay, speak up.
Yeah, Henry Springer in Anchorage. I think in conjunction with that amendment, it's important what the definition of warranty is. In a normal performance contract that doesn't involve product warranty, there is no warranty with the project. The final acceptance is the release of the bonding or surety that constitutes the end of the project and the end of the warranty. Where warranties come in are products that are specified in the contract where the contractor has some longer-term warranty performance specified. So I agree with Representative Boyer. It shouldn't be a problem from the standpoint of project. It's a problem from the standpoint of products within the project.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay, number 3, change the interest on retainage in section 3690-258. From AS 4544, anyway, without all the citations, they want to change the interest rate that's established in the bill from 10.5% to a prevailing rate of interest. Comment.
Senator Zemanski, members of the committee. Yes, that in very often in the current situation, there's municipalities are not getting 10.5%. on their money, they'd be being penalized doubly for paying interest and also having to pay more because of the 10.5% interest. So our request would be that would be changed to a prevailing rate. I do have one suggestion from one of our members that the definition of that could be tied to the 90-day T-bill rate, or it could be tied to something else, but it'd be a prevailing rate rather than the 10.5% rate.
Senator.
Right. I'm trying to think now of a situation in which retainage would be retained. Let's say you have a construction project and the punch list hasn't yet been completed. Does the owner or the municipality have to pay, and let's say you were retaining 5% and there was a punch list that was not completed. Do you have to pay interest on the money from the time? And let's say that the contractor had submitted a final bill for work that, and he says it's complete, and you say, well, it's not complete. You got these 37 items yet to be
taken care of. Are you saying that you would have to pay retainage on that, interest on that 5% that you retained in order, with the intent that he, be induced to complete those 37 items? Or when does the interest start?
My understanding is, and I would stand to be corrected if someone is, that it paid whatever we hold over when we pay the majority of the bill, and we're holding 5 or 10%, that we are required under current law to pay 10.5% on that money.
So the point is that it's under current law.
Right.
Yeah. Anytime there's a contested, if you contest the paying of the bill because you haven't finished the punch list order, that doesn't change the current system of requiring them to pay on a retainage. In that case, you wouldn't incur a penalty either. So because there was a disagreement, and you respond within a certain amount of time here, and so I don't think it's affected either.
So what is the current law?
10.5.
Senator Pichot.
Mr. Chairman, one of the indications of being around here too long is that where all of these past arguments flash before your eyes and you can't quite grasp what it is. But when you and I were in finance years ago, and Senator Frank, we had the state purchasing law before us. We had a whole discussion of 10.5, and as I recall at that time, there were some good reasons even our people argued in favor of an arbitrary rate, not a prevailing rate. Those arguments escaped me, but it might be interesting to get our own state purchasing people to comment on the statutory law, because it seemed like we had debated prevailing rate when it came to the state law, and I think we were talked out of it, that there was some problematic reasons for there were some problems involved in trying to continue to calculate prevailing rates.
Well, just to throw out food for thought on that subject, as long as we're going to take a look at it, when I looked at it a couple days ago, I think that the whole basis behind this is to get prompt payment going. If current retainage is governed by statute, why would we want to change the status quo? Is there a compelling reason to change the status quo?
Introduce your own bill.
Mr. Chairman? I think the compelling reason to reduce the status quo would be, and it's very, I don't know when, Senator Pichot, you were having this discussion, but the prevailing rate could have been much higher than 10.5% also at that point. A contractor knows when he goes into a contract, that part is also written in, and if it's written in, it's that it's a prevailing rate, whatever. He knows that that's a cost, that he shouldn't be making, our feeling is he shouldn't be making money on that. It's a part of his cost of doing business, and if he's not, he wouldn't be getting any more than 10.5 or whatever the prevailing rate was on it. We're certainly not getting it from that.
Help me.
Positions we should be spending, or we should be are paying we, out no more than we're able to earn on that.
Are we confusing retainage with what is non-promptly paid monies? Or you call retainage non-promptly paid monies?
No.
So what's the interest rate on non-promptly paid monies?
As I understand it in this bill, Senator Szymanski, it is that the payment on non-promptly paid monies is the same as the retainage rate in 4545-010. And our request would be that the retainage rate as well as the interest on non-promptly paid monies both would be reduced to the prevailing rate.
Which is
in the citation is in 4545-010A is where that's established.
Right, because there's a lot of different ways. If that's really the incentive, as I discussed with you informally, you could leave a prevailing rate for 30 days and then triple it after 30 days and then really give it an encouragement to pay it. But that would really speed up the work. But I don't know. Anyway, any other comments on the network on this particular retainage percentage change from 10.5% to prevailing? Comments?
Yes, I'd like to make a comment. Can you hear me?
Yeah, give us your name and who you're representing.
My name is Gerald Rexwinkle. I'm the controller for the municipality of Anchorage. I'm representing the finance department. We currently have in our contracts provisions for the payment of a specified rate of interest on retainage, and that interest rate is 8%. you know, we don't particularly care for the state to dictate payment terms and how we do business, and we like a flat rate of interest because of the computational problems that would be involved in a floating rate, but we don't agree with 10.5%, and that's why we have contractual provisions in our contract that specify 8%.
Well, how do you, what do you do on state funded work, which I'm told the law says it's 10.5%?
Well, my understanding is that we pay 8% now. Maybe my understanding in all of our contracts is not correct, but I believe that we can presently contract for a different rate of interest if that's what we have in our contract, if the contractor agrees to it.
Is that the escape mechanism that's in here that says if we don't like one of the provisions in the legislation, we'll make it a provision of contract?
Well, I'm not sure, but the new bill here in section 36.90.270 under waiver of provisions prohibited now states that a contract provision that waives a provision required by the statutes that we're looking at now is void. And so, according to this, then we could not agree with a contractor to different rates of interest.
I am curious how you're at 8, and if somebody else tell me, does department or anybody else know whether or not, can we confirm that 10.5 is mandatory? Any legal beagles out there? I'd ask Plasma. He doesn't know.
From my own experience, the 10.5% is only at current time being paid on direct contracts with the state of Alaska. When the municipalities are paying even out of grant monies at this current time, they are not paying the 10.5%. I can't tell you if they're breaking the law by doing that, but I can tell you that in their contracts, they all are not paying the 10.5% as in the state statute.
For the record, is this Roxanne?
No.
Yes, it is.
Okay, Rox, name and who you're representing.
Okay. Can I do that again now?
Better do it now, because they're going to listen to this tape and transcribe it.
Okay. This is Roxanna Herschel, Acme Fence Company.
Okay. So is there any other comments on that proposed amendment? Sounds like I got to do a little more homework on that one, too.
Dave Palmer, Petersburg.
Dave?
This is just a guess, but it may be that the 10.5% is what's required to pay on bills that are overdue, and that the 8% that Anchorage uses is a contractual amount that deals with the retainage as part of a contract, and I suspect that that's where you'd find the difference. You have to just look up the statute that requires 10.5 to see how it reads.
We're in the process of doing it. I have my legal counsel here working on it. But
this is just the reference.
We'll move ahead then if there's no other comments. Any other comments on that point?
I have a comment. This is from Fairbanks.
Go ahead. Name who you're representing.
Jay Slager, the CFO from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. We do pay 10.5%, and I don't know the lady that referred to everybody not paying it. I think local government does pay it unless it's there might be a provision in the statute for all rural first-class municipalities to set their own contract rates for retainage.
Okay, appreciate it. Any other comments?
Terry Tarantino, building official, CITCA. There may be a confusion in the semantic definitions here between retainage, project, withholding for non-performance or poor quality work and late money, and I sense that there's some confusion in people's minds about the differences in those definitions.
Well, I sensed that earlier, but nobody sensed it with us, so it sounds like we're real clear. Retainage is retainage in any form, whether it's retained for warranty work, retainage for any purposes at all, as long as it's underneath. Retainage is usually shows up when the owner sends you back your check, and he's got a little note on there that says, based on your submittal, you're entitled to X, and we kept X under retainage. And that's usually pretty clear. What they are talking about, I think, and I don't think there's any question in my mind, is when they submit the bill to them and they don't get any check back. And it's when they don't get any check back after the time period specified in the bill that penalties and interest begin. So I think everybody's pretty clear on it. I hope it's clear in the statute, but we're going to make sure.
Thank you.
Next item. Anybody else? That's it. We're going number four. Amendment of the bill allow municipalities to pay interest on retained funds and under the new provisions of the bill from state grants. Again, are we in four? You're back into retainage language.
Right. Senator Zemanski, committee members. Yes, this, Ms. Herschel, I believe her name is, refers to the fact that that this bill has been already amended to allow municipalities to use state grant funds to pay interest. The interest that's referred to, however, is just the interest on the retained funds, and our request would be that any additional interest required for late payments should also be considered as a cost of doing the project and should be should be acceptable to be paid with state funds.
And if I could, paraphrase that, you're saying that if we tell you that you got to pay the penalties, we should allow you to pay for it out of the money from the state.
Yes, sir.
That we send you. And you want specific authority and statute to do that.
Right.
Any comments from the sponsor? He looks like he's about ready to give in on this one.
Could I speak to that? I'm Jenny Slater from Fairbanks.
Speak to it.
We have 108, maybe 110 service areas in Fairbanks, in addition to the borough and the city. But the commission or board, a group of local residents who manages that service area. And we've chosen that the contracts that those service areas have, construction contracts, that approval of our paying the bill out of their funds basically has to go back to that service area board. And if any of you are familiar with Fairbanks, most of those are road service areas. There are 3 to 5 members on a road service area board. And just the time to get a board meeting together, if a bill comes in, after the engineers have done their work, they're certified the work is done and the bill's ready to pay, and if it gets back to the office to be paid, I'd say more likely than not, it's just impossible to get it done in 21 days. So this provision would allow, when it doesn't get the check written within 21 days from the time the bill came in the door, allow that the interest come out of the project.
I think you slipped down amendment. I think you went down one amendment on me with regard to your comments, but do you have any particular comment with regard to allowing state grants to be used for making payments of interest on retained funds?
I think that we are going to get in the loop of having to pay a lot of interest on these projects that are particularly service area-oriented projects.
Okay.
I think that the project should be picking up the interest.
Okay, any other comments on that provision? How about from the committee? Any strong feelings one way or the other?
Well, I have one. This is Roxanne Herschel. Ask the defense company to increase again.
Go to it.
A comment on the payment practices of that. I don't know how the state of Alaska is going to feel about granting money, almost promoting late payments. I think that this is something that the committee needs to work on a little bit further rather than just saying, you know, that these can be out of the regular payments, the interest paid out of state grants. Currently, we understand about different areas where the project engineers have to approve it, but also understand that when we're working out in these outlining areas, they have project engineers that are on site and they're daily inspecting that work. And once a progress payment or a request is signed, that signature is the end. That's the invoice right there. They've already looked over that project and they already know what's going on. So, you know, to say that we can't get those payments out quickly and that there's going to be a lot of money spent on interest, I'm a little confused. And another comment I have is, again, realize that the federal government right now is paying within 7 days. They're, you know, a lot bigger than the state of Alaska or the municipalities, and they have a lot of work to do to get those payments out, but they are complying within 7 days.
Thank you, Roxanne. Okay, any other comments on that provision? I don't detective sensing, but we will have the ability to take a look. After a valid bill has, or what valid bill's been received, the 8-day notice period should be extended to at least 8 working days. So there's two things that you're asking for in the amendment. You're asking that somehow we come up with a definition of a valid bill, and I'm not too sure how we're going to do that. The other one is that we get down to counting working days and not, I guess calendar days is the term, but misbelief.
Yes, Senator Zmanski, committee members, that's accurate. Starting with the one that I think is easier in definition, definitely an 8-day notice period. When you're talking calendar days, it can get to be pretty short. You have a long holiday, you have somebody on vacation. I think 8 working days is certainly a much more reasonable timeline, because I just think that you end up, if you have to have somebody review it, in a lot of instances we have small communities where we only have one person who can do any one thing, or maybe only, they only do it as a quarter of the time or whatever. So that's the question.
Chairman, that's the problem. One, we've excluded communities of under 800, so I think you get to the problem where you've got somebody who's only doing this a very small part of the time. But the point is, you could literally stop the clock for a month if someone were on vacation under the suggestion you just made.
I wouldn't be asking for vacation time, but I think that working days as opposed to holidays, a 4-day, the 4th of July holiday or something like that, sometime where an office is closed and that's a normal office closed period.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
could I speak to that? I'm Judy Slater from Fairbanks. Again, I reiterate that our policy is, much like a lot of the small communities around the state, that the legislative body actually approves a bill, the literal bill from the contractor, before we can make payments. And in the case of the service area board, so that is a service area board. It has to be done in an official meeting, just like polling in the legislature every day. But these happen about maybe once a month, once every 2 months, and they have to be called specially to authorize the payment of a bill.
Question.
We have to give legal notice.
Senator Frank.
We would strongly suggest that the time period from the time a bill comes in the door to the time
Mr. Chairman, looking just quickly at the provisions, it appears, and I'll look at it more closely, that the 8-day requirement only applies to contractor, subcontractor contracts and not to municipalities. And so I'll take a close look at it, but I don't think that's a problem in this particular case either.
Well, and I know you've got to run. I'd like to get one other quick comment from you. We'll have an opportunity to work on it in the next couple of days when Roxanne gets down here. But a political subdivision, in current statute, it says a political subdivision has a population of 500 or less, exempt from the payment of interest provided in C of this subsection, which is basically retainage. Why don't we make it 500 instead? Why set one at 500 in this statute and 800 underneath your statute?
Does
yours say 500?
It does. Ours embraces the 500 in that particular section, and it only reflects communities of 800 or more. I forget which section it is, but we didn't change the other sections of law.
I just make 500 across the board.
Would have been wonderful, Mr. Chairman, but that we didn't have the vote support on the House floor.
What was your original version?
We didn't allow communities to escape at all.
Is that your desire?
Mr. Chairman, I've made a commitment to support the product that the House has sent over to the Senate.
Okay. That'd be another item we can work on. I'll let you go. Are there any comments from teleconference network individuals on that? Any additional comments on that? Any comments from people in the committee hearing today? Okay. What I will do then is ask whether or not there are any other proposed amendments by anybody, either on the teleconference, present here today, that would like to have considered on this bill. I'd like to bring them forward at this time. If not, please get in touch with my office tomorrow, and that's an open invitation to all parties.
I have one item, and this is Darrell and Rex Michael Anchorage again, and this act is supposed to take effect July 1st, 1989, and which means you're going back a year almost on this, and I was...
We'll, never fear, we'll fix the effective date.
A retroactive.
No, we... Never fear. We'll have an effective date in the CS. It'll be July 1, 1990. Okay, any other comments? Hearing none. Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on HB 284. The next one that we're going to take a quick look at is another favorite of ours. House Bill 139, Payment and Purchase of Schools and Municipalities. The bill before you is originally done by, I understand, Labor and Commerce Committee. And the sponsor, chairman of the committee, was here with us. The Municipal League again addressed us a specific amendment request on this bill. Crystal Smith, you want to join us?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Porcio. Yes, our request for this, which I believe you have in front of you, was attached to the memorandum of March 15th also. This bill has continued to cause us trouble, but I think if it's going to go, we want to be sure that we're not looking at essentially an 18% per annum interest rate, which this bill calls for in its original form. It's 1.5% per month in interest rate, and if my understanding is correct, there's no proration even of that 1.5%. So our request would be that the rate be referred back to that same statute or the same.
Just happens we have a citation.
Just have a citation for that, right? It's right here too in our proposed amendment that it be referred back to that AS 4545-010A. Where it's now, which is now set at 10.5% per year, and that also allows for prorationing of that on a portion of a month basis.
Senator Pershaw, you had a comment on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, don't you think that ought to be a prevailing rate instead of a fixed rate?
We would go for
rate
prevailing
rate. Oh, sorry.
I mean, if actually you see that our amount referred back to that, if we were to amend the other bill and change that rate, then that would be fine. But
so what you'd rather do, if nothing else, you would accept the 4545-010A.
Nothing else.
Which is 10.5%.
139 is going to go, yes, we would have
well,
to accept that.
Well, I can guess if there's a will on the committee to move it along, it will move along. So, Mr. Senator Pershaw, you any comment or feeling on that one?
Well, having just read the law that we passed for the state a while back, I'm not familiar with all the details on this, but I am sympathetic with the prompt payment concept, and I would agree that there's no need to be punitive on the interest rate on it, and it would seem like it should be the same rate as what we're talking about for the state and construction contracts with municipalities.
Okay. What I'd like to do is let you reflect on that. We will get that amendment to each one of the committee members. And again, HB 139, we may be bringing that one up on Tuesday to deal with it as early as Tuesday. While we'll wait and see, we may end up wanting to bring it back up on Thursday. And we'll get that amendment to individual members with a copy of the background. And I'll instruct staff to give it some knowledge. If the sponsor is with us, I'd like to take the sponsor. Join us, please. And for the record, Representative Donnelly has joined us, Labor Commerce Chairman of the House. The Representative Donnelly, the Municipal League has proposed amendment to HB 139, which the committee has taken a look at and has been, on a previous bill, been looking at statutory citation 45-45010A, which establishes basically a 10.5% interest rate. The committee is, and my sensing out of the committee that Senator Show and Senator Frank and others are looking for a consistent application in statute of percentages. And I was wondering whether or not you had a feeling on that, one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad I dropped by. I was up here looking for some of my members to create a quorum downstairs. Mr. Chairman, the proposal that I've seen the committee substitute basically would gut the bill. I mean, it really wouldn't mean much if you did that. The proposal that from the House, the 1.5% monthly, is what the state currently pays, and it's the standard that the state pays people that it owes money now if it pays late. And that it's actually had the result in saving the state a lot of money, Mr. Chairman. There was a testimony all through the House from the Department Administration and others. When it first happened, the state was opposed to it, but they found that now they're inspired to pay their bills on time, so they're not paying the late penalties. And they were paying interest before, now they're not, so it's actually saved money. So the 1.5% is intended to be a penalty, which is exactly the same as what the state statute currently pays when we pay late. So in the House, we thought if it's good for the state, it should be good for the cities and the local governments, because it doesn't make any sense to put in the same interest rate as the prevailing interest rate, because then, Mr. Chairman, since it's a statutory set, it may actually be a disincentive to pay their bills on time, because if they can go out in the open market and get a higher rate, they'll actually delay paying because they're holding on to the corpus of that interest, and they can make more someplace else than they could actually paying their bills on time. So that was
I'm glad you came to the committee meeting today. It's a compelling argument. Senator Pershaw.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is yet another reflection on the poorness of my memory, because now Representative Donnelly reminds us that I think, in my own mind, I'm getting very confused, I think, between construction contract requirements, which we've been looking at for state and proposed local, versus procurement, I assume paper pencil procurement penalties, which we also debated several years ago. And what we've been wrestling with is both construction, prompt payment, and now procurement. And I guess our question, as the chairman made reference to, is still perhaps the same, is why are we looking at different penalties for construction versus procurement? Is there something inherent in the differences between those kinds of purchases or payments that warrant differences, or do we just have different histories of the two problems?
To the chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was strictly to address the procurement-type situations and where a private individual was owed money from a municipal government or school district. We wanted to do it to conform with what the state currently has adopted for the law for itself, for the benefit of these businesses that, you know, have said that they're not getting paid on time. The same proposal was presented in the House, I think, it was defeated. I think it was also presented on the House floor and was defeated, the going to the other interest rate. And
to the 10.5%.
Right. That was defeated on the floor of the House, is my recollection. I know we talked about it a lot in committee, and it did pass unanimously on the floor of the House at this level, because that was the whole point of the bill.
Well, but going back to, and I hate to make you pull you in on the other bill, but we are looking at both bills concurrently, and one reason that I wanted to look at both bills together is that there's got to be some consistency. You would hope some consistency in this process, but quite often there's a saying around here that consistency is not necessarily one of our greater virtues. But a penalty is different than, say, retainage. Retainage is banking somebody else's money down the road. It's not a penalty. So if and I guess what I'm offering to Senator Pichot for food for thought before we come back on the other one, when we look at the, I have to agree with what I'm hearing from the sponsor here, is that a penalty is a penalty, and you should put a higher level of interest rate on a penalty versus what you'd normally have for a retainage. And you may have helped us along on the other bill as well, because...
retainage is just, it ought to be the same, held harmless.
Held harmless. It's kind of like a held harmless position. But on an unpaid bill, you want to, whether it's an unpaid bill for construction work that's done or for the delivery of paper, failure to promptly pay should probably have a penalty assigned to it that is higher than prevailing interest rate. And I'd like to then switch back over to Ms. Bullock for a quick comment.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pichot, Representative Donnelly, I think we have to go back to your earlier question about whether there's a compelling reason for the state to be telling municipalities what to do. And I think if we get into this question, you're talking about a municipality buying its supplies, arranging for the operation of local government, and those bills, those contracts are made from municipality to suppliers. Those suppliers know who they're doing business with. They know that they can come right back to the local governing body to get that bill paid. If you, in the legislature, pass money for some for Department of Administration to buy pencils and paper, you don't have to approve that bill, and nobody can come back to you and say, Senator Pichot, Senator Zemanski, we didn't get paid. The state has an administrative structure that pays bills within a municipal government. Bills of any, it depends on the government, depends how, what we're talking about in terms of size of government and size of bill, but a large number of those bills have to be approved by governing bodies. There are also governing bodies, elected officials who are sitting right there, who those suppliers can come back to. So we get back to this question. I think there are two questions. I think there is the question of why is there a compelling reason for the state to be telling the municipalities what to do in this regard, and there's also the question of the interest rate. And you know, those, there are two separate arguments, and we lost the first one in the House. I don't think we necessarily have to lose it in the Senate. The second one about the interest rate is another question.
But you got to help us along. I mean, you know,
we don't oppose paying our bills, and most of our municipalities have ordinances that say we will pay our bills in X number of days. They do. We, as I recall, I was not in on all of this, all of the testimony for this bill in the House, because I wasn't handling it, but I don't recall that, from what I heard, that we had any comments from specific suppliers saying these people don't pay their bills. If the municipality of Anchorage doesn't pay its bills, why don't people go to the municipality of Anchorage and complain? Why do they come to the legislature? Have the legislature impose regulations on all municipalities, most of whom are already taking care of paying their bills. Either they're paying them within 30 days, they're paying within 2 weeks, they're paying them as soon as their governing body or their operations. We have the situation in Fairbanks that Judy mentioned where they have to go through a service area and they have to go through the various steps. We aren't opposed to paying our bills on time. That's certainly not, we're not trying to get away with anything, but we think we have the right to run municipal government.
Okay, I don't intend to necessarily run a debate on the bill right now. My inclination is to hear more direct response to, do you have a response? I guess you have responded that you're in support of the amendment as proposed, because you're saying that if the state's going to impose it, they should not make it an onerous provision. The sponsor's saying, guess what? If you're going to pass a penalty, then pass a penalty. Don't just pass on the prevailing interest rate. Otherwise, no sense in passing the bill.
Well, Senator Zemanski, 18% is, and when 1 day equals, 1 day is 1.5% per month, is an excessive amount. It adds quite a bit to the cost of municipal government. We are trying to deal with what we have in our reduced resources, and if we add this kind of penalty, when in some instances it can't be, you know, there are compelling reasons why a bill may be a week late or whatever. And I do think on this issue, too, we've got people online who are very ready to discuss this.
Are the timelines identical in the two provisions? Did we make them? Did your timelines the same as what we had in 284, public construction contracts.
Mr. Chairman, the timelines in our bill, the bill is the pay on time bill, are different at the request of the municipalities. In fact, we've made them very little. To begin with, they don't even start to run until 30 days after all the goods are received and all the appropriate billings are received by the municipality actually responsible for the payment. So the timelines don't even begin until the billings are received and all the goods have been received. Secondly, we've waived the timelines if the municipalities simply agree at the time of the order with the contractor that they need more time. They can get more time. All they have to do is agree going in up front. So there isn't this situation that we got testimony on in the House where somebody thought they were supposed to get paid and then they didn't get paid for months and months and months and months, and they couldn't have any recourse other than going to court with the people, right? So all they got to do is agree ahead of time and let their contractors know that they don't want to pay in 30 days, and they could reach an agreement for that. And lastly, the statute does not apply if the muni already has an ordinance providing for prompt payment, which is substantially similar to this bill. So the defense that we're already doing this is totally, it just supports this bill in itself, because the minorities out there obviously are the problems, and this bill is addressed to those, and it's certainly not going to have any impact on the people that are already paying their bills on time. So those arguments are all specious.
Response?
I'd like to ask Senator Zemanski, if I could, to have some of the people directly representing the municipality speak on this. I know.
Okay, let's do that then. Thank you, Crystal. Stand by with us on this one. Going out to the teleconference network, who'd like to go first?
Okay. Good day, Paul in Petersburg.
Okay.
Thank you. I guess I have to say that if 18% up from 10.5% is the legislature's idea of helping cities save money, I say thanks anyway. I suggest you repeal the Little Davis Bacon Law, fully fund the municipal assistance programs, the senior citizens programs, and kill the governor's programs for mandatory jails and law enforcement, and all those seem to trickle down to us. I don't think an additional penalty on late payment is necessarily going to save us money. As was mentioned, I think this is probably in the minority. It doesn't happen that often, although it does occur. We have an IBM computer installed here. It didn't work right, and we're not paying that bill, and IBM understands that until we get the thing to run right. But the way I understand this bill, if IBM wanted to post the fact, if this thing was passed, we'd own 18%. Just don't think that we need that kind of help. Thanks.
Okay, next. Senator Pichot, did you have a question before we move to the next person?
Yeah, Dave, I'm not sure that's not my reading in the case of the dispute. I think that there is a provision for disputes on whether or not you've actually gotten something that worked right or something that was met the specs of what you purchased. We may want to go back and look at that, but there is a whole section dealing with bills in dispute.
Okay, thanks. Well, if you could do that, that would help. The experience I've had here is really the other way around. We've had contractors in town that leave town and leave owing bills. And in fact, in some cases, the city has paid our local merchants, and then we've gone after the contractor. It works both ways, and I think that unless you really have some compelling reasons and some really serious examples of mistrust here, that the legislature has just let the local governments handle their problems to the extent they can.
Thank you. Next person like to testify? Speak up. And I'd like to address, if we could, the bill or specifically the proposed amendment to delete the penalty provision. Nobody else wants to testify, so be it. What I'm going to do is hold House Bill 139. I will be bringing it up probably, my guess is, with the other bill, because my inclination is to look at some consistencies with regard to timelines. between these two pieces of legislation, look at some consistencies with regard to penalties, and my reading of it is we may want to, at least the contractor's bill, look at going to the same similar type of penalty provision under the category of non-payment or prompt payment of the bill themselves, and maybe we'll have a second amendment drafted on that, which we can put before the committee and consider. The other consistency, the other thing I'm curious about is I'm going to be looking at that language related to the local governments being able to put a substantially similar ordinance on the record that may allow them to, in both bills, give them that same opportunity if they want. And I'd like to get, and I'd like maybe to get local governments to give me some feedback on that in both bills, having that provision available in both bills. And I'm not too sure what the impact of that will be. Roxanne, we'll get a chance to talk with you this next week on that. Roxanne, and with that then, HB 139 is sitting on the side. Last but not least today, House Bill 358, Thermal Lighting Standards. The confusion again continues to exist on CSs and CSs being drafted. Apparently, House Bill 358, which we have not had before the committee at this time, is before the committee. The bill before the committee relating to minimal thermal and lighting energy standards and providing for an effective date was sponsored by Representative Brown. She is on her way. I'd like to have, I guess we could take a few seconds. Is she going to be on her way up, or do you want to wing it?
She's going to be here instantaneously. She's been waiting for the call.
Okay. And is teleconference online on 358 too? Are there people listening on House Bill 358? I didn't check my notes over here. House Bill 358. Are you here, Oz? Greg? Don't get too close to the mic. Back off the microphone about half a foot. Can you hear us now? Are you there? Well, now we've been joined by the sponsor. What I'd like to do is defer to the sponsor. First of all, House Bill 358, I will take sponsor testimony, and then we'll talk about the bill, and then we'll take public testimony on the bill. I had hoped to be able to move the bill along today, but I understand the sponsor has generated a CS, which we've received today. And what I'd like to do is then bring it back before the committee on Tuesday. And hopefully by Tuesday, be able to move the bill along. My hope would be that in moving along, we'd have some downstream concurrence that the problems have been worked out on the bill and that there's no problems in future committees. So with that, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate you taking this legislation up today. This would require that future new houses built with state financial assistance meet at least minimum thermal energy efficiency standards. And the state standard would not apply to homes built out of pocket or not financed with state financial assistance. Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much time you have, and if there are members of the public who are waiting to testify, I think I would like to defer to them, and since I have provided you with a written statement which addresses the need for the legislation, which I feel is compelling, the history of how we got to this point. Very briefly, there was legislation passed in 1980. On a technicality, the court ruled that the legislation only covered construction financing or construction lending and not the financial assistance provided through our major agency, AHFC. So Following that Superior Court decision, I introduced House Bill 358 last year to return us to the original intent that was adopted in the legislature in 1980. There is broad support for this legislation from numerous professionals in the housing industry as well as many other people and groups throughout the state. And one point I did want to emphasize to you is this bill would not prescribe any specific standard, but rather would authorize the Department of Community and Regional Affairs to move forward through the regulatory process in adopting a new standard. The written comments that I provided you, Mr. Chairman, describe the changes that have been proposed in the committee substitute, in the proposed committee substitute that's before you. And I have been working with members of the Alaska State Home Builders Association to try to address concerns that they have. One new feature of this proposed committee substitute is that it would establish a residential energy standards technical advisory committee with designated seats for home builder representatives from across the state to guide the formulation of a new standard. And it's my expectation that the selection of those members of that advisory group would be from nominations submitted by the home builders. And I think this is a positive feature. It will have a small fiscal note, which I understand has been prepared and provided to you by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. It also adds language to explicitly require that specific consideration be given to the availability of inexpensive home heating sources, primarily natural gas, when making the determination as to whether the minimum standards are economically justifiable. It also adds language to ensure that the standard is cost-effective by ensuring that incremental costs attributable to meeting the standard are justified by the resulting energy cost savings. And finally, it would establish an early adopter program, defer the implementation of the standard for 1 year, and make it possible for early adopters of the new standard to receive a $1,500 incentive award for voluntarily meeting the standard during the first year or this interim period before it takes effect. The cost of that early adopter program is about $250,000, which would provide for 167 grants at $1,500 each. And we arrived at that number, Mr. Chairman, based on the department's estimation of how many new housing starts would be likely in this period, in the one-year period, before the standard became mandatory. So I think in light of our general commitment of the state to energy, we've spent $1.6 billion on energy projects and programs of various sorts, yet we have not adequately addressed one of our most basic needs, affordable, energy-efficient housing. And I think that perhaps the Rail Belt Energy Fund could be considered as a funding source for the early adopter program. And, Mr. Chairman, what I would suggest is that the legislation does not mandate the funding of this program, but, of course, if the funding is not available, then the program would not be operational, but that we would move the legislation forward, as you suggest, next week and work with the members of the Senate Finance Committee to determine the availability of getting some funds allocated to fund this legislation or the early adopter feature of the legislation. Otherwise, it had a zero fiscal note coming in here. It has picked up a small fiscal note as a result of adding the technical advisory committee. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you have, Mr. Chairman.
First question is, who ordered up to see us? Did you or did my staff?
I believe Eric Myers of my staff, in conjunction with your staff, have been working on it. I'm not sure who actually asked that it be provided.
Because, to be candid with you, I'd like to treat it the number of amendments that you proposed individually. And my desire is traditionally to take the committee, each individual amendment, deal with them, look at it, and then we can take a sensing on it. But to drop a CS on the committee is pretty sweeping as this is a little hard to accept. So what I'm going to do is basically disregard the CS as currently drafted. We'll have individual amendments drafted, and then what we will do is we'll bring the individual amendments before us, unless somehow we can draw consensus in between now and say Tuesday. But then we can always adopt a CS in committee as we adopt the amendments. So that's generally how I like to work it. Because there's some concerns, I know, by at least myself, about several of the points, and maybe let me just touch on one of them. And I know Senator Pierce, who will be here on Tuesday, has already looked at some of the proposed CSs and has indicated concern over amending the bill at all. She kind of liked it in current form, but I thought I'd just express that as part of the, for your information. But one of the language talks about adding language that explicitly requires specific condition to be given to the availability of inexpensive home heating energy sources, natural gas, and making determination whether the minimum standards are economically justifiable. The question that comes up on that is, what may be economically justifiable today may not be economically, maybe justifiable 5 years from now, if the source changes. How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that I have supported and fully support the bill in its present form. My motivation in bringing these possible amendments to your committee is to try to get the support of the home builders. They have had some concerns about it, and I'm sure there are probably people standing by that could speak specifically to why they wish to see the legislation amended in this way. So
maybe that's
we in the department have, and the department have been working with them to try to articulate, I think, what we all agree on, which is that some kind of standard is appropriate, and I'm convinced that the energy efficiency standards are cost justifiable, and that it will not fundamentally change the thrust of what we're doing here to state that that is an explicit consideration, because I believe they are clearly cost justifiable, but there is some dispute about that. And you may want to hear from other people about it, but okay. I think the point you make about the future is absolutely right.
But let's do that then, Representative Brown. Let's go to the teleconference, pick up testimony on teleconference, and then we come on back here. We've got time. I would really like to close out of here in about 5 or 10 minutes, but let's just see what it looks like on the teleconference. Apparently, we have, do we have Greg Jones online with us?
Senator Szymanski, can you hear me?
Yes. Greg, and then who else is on this particular bill? Is there anybody else there in Anchorage?
Steve Baden for the Department of Community and Regional Affairs.
Okay, wants to testify? Who wants, I just like to get a handle on who wants to testify.
Okay, I can go ahead and start.
Greg, you're the only one that wants to testify on Teleconference Network on this bill at this time?
Even from Community and Regional Affairs, which is to here in Anchorage.
Okay.
Also, thank you.
Why don't you go ahead?
Well, who do you want me to, this is Greg Jones. Did you
Greg,
want me to go
yeah,
ahead?
Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Okay, hopefully you can hear me. This is Greg Jones. I'm representing the Alaska State Home Builders Association. I'm here to testify in favor of for Senate Bill CS, the committee substitute, the sponsor substitute for HB 358, in the form presented to you today by Representative Brown. I first want to just start out by thanking Representative Brown for the effort that she has put in over the last few months. We had a situation that was characterized by fear, confusion, to a certain extent, mistrust, in short, a real Donnybrook going for the last couple of years involving the home builders in the state of Alaska. Representative Brown walked into the middle of that a few months ago and has really worked hard, along with Eric Myers from her staff and with the staff at DCRA, worked hard to bring us all together. And we are here today to support what Representative Brown has presented to you, much to our own surprise, quite frankly. It has been a long but very rewarding process. We think the changes that she has proposed in the committee substitute that has been laid on the table represents a very workable bill in terms of the home builders' concerns that we have been expressing for the last couple of years. We are told by the BCRA staff that it accomplishes what they would like to accomplish, and we feel quite certain that it will eventually result in the higher quality, more energy-efficient construction techniques throughout the state of Alaska. I would urge you to consider the entire committee substitute together rather than individually. We think the package works well together as presented today. Specifically, Senator Szymanski, concerning your question about future changes in energy sources and how that might affect the cost, the applicability of the regulations, the intent of the Technical Advisory Committee and the regulations themselves is to build in a continual review of energy costs so that at some point when energy costs do rise, a given area then will become, the standards will become mandatory in those areas. We are all aware that energy costs are generally going to rise throughout the state of Alaska. The intent of the legislation in its current form is to eventually make these regulations mandatory throughout the state of Alaska as those costs rise. And one of the reasons that the Alaska State Home Builders Association likes the legislation as currently written is because it does take that into account. We take a baseline reading of the state in terms of its energy costs and construction cost indexes, and as those change over the years, the regulation accommodates them as it's currently written. Eventually, we have a mandatory regulation throughout the state that everyone has learned to live with, and most important, the consumer has learned to expect. When we get to that point, we will have a demand for houses built according to these regulations. Value will be created in those houses as a result of that demand, and we'll end up with a far improved quality of construction improved quality of construction over what we're doing today. Our concern from the very beginning has been selling this program to the public, and we think the way this is written now, that we can sell it to the public to the point that that it will be in great demand within a very few years. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. Steve Baden from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs is also here and would like to testify to the committee.
Thank you. Would you go ahead?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand what you said.
Would you tell him go ahead? Is he there?
Yes. This is Steve Baden. I'm in Chief of Energy Programs with the Alaska Department of Community and Regional Affairs. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs strongly supports this bill because it will clear the way to implement a minimum energy installation standards for new homes financed with state funds. I may note that this process has been this year has been 10 years in the making, and it's high time that a state have a minimum insulation standard. Energy is a critical concern for Alaskan homeowners. Energy represents the highest cost of housing for Alaskans outside of rent and mortgage payments. Alaskans spend over $100 million a year just for staying warm. Sure. And construction in Alaska presents a special challenge all too often because homes are not built to the state's climate. This is particularly prevalent in rural Alaska, for example, where recent housing needs assessments found that almost a third of homes do not maintain a healthy indoor temperature through the long, cold winter months. For this reason, the department favors the enactment of House Bill 358. If there's any questions, be glad to answer them.
Senator Pichot.
Steve, this is Pat Pichot. I'm looking through the bill here for the definitions of state funds. On your program that you do with the housing authorities through DCRA, we provide a percentage of state funds to match of the bulk federal funds to cover houses in excess of the average allowable cost of $90,000. How does that figure into the requirements of this bill?
this, because the state does contribute that supplemental funding for the rural housing authorities, the law would cover the rural housing authorities. And also, in addition, the main funding from that program comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Urban Development. And their program is in a position where that if there's a local or state code, they would recognize that standard or code to be the code by which homes are constructed to.
Okay, that's good. Of course, let's think that through a little bit. Does that mean then that if you added a $1,500 or $2,500 to the cost of the house, that we would not get any additional allowance for that under the federal code, and so that those additional costs would go on top of the general fund supplemental appropriation to the project, to the program?
One of the things that brings to your attention is in 1988, the Alaska legislature amended that supplemental development fund to include energy efficiency as part of the cost the fund can be used for. Prior to that, the fund could only be used for electrical line extensions, sewer extensions, and roads. And so in 1988, the legislature opened that fund up to